Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. It's Michael Shelley here. So WFMU's Amanda and Matt Fiveash, who both do shows Thursdays on the Give the Drummer stream, in addition to the WFMU regular stuff that's streamed that's on the air. There's also a bunch of alternative streams. Not everybody knows that. They're very much worth checking out, especially if what's currently on the regular WFMU airwaves isn't grooving you. You can sort of turn over to one of these alternative streams, and sometimes what's there might hit the spot. You can check out Amanda and Matt's shows at WFMU.org/drummer. So why do I mention them? Because they were vacationing in Puerto Rico, and they went to this place called Carly Munoz's Carly's Bistro and Piano, which is a fine dining restaurant with a little sort of nightclub. And Carly Munoz is the owner, and he is a guy who's kind of a legendary sideman to the Beach Boys. And they said they talked to him, and he was kind of the nicest guy, and that he'd make a great interview. And so they put me in touch with him, and that's what we're going to hear today. So he and I talked for way over an hour. And this interview, I cut out some just because it just, I don't know, I think people can only... I don't know how much people can take, but people seem to like slightly shorter. So I really didn't cut out. I cut out kind of bad questions on my part, because Carly was charming and very forthcoming and has done a lot of cool stuff. So very, very interesting. I also want to point out that there is a book called The Beach Boys in Concert, and I interviewed the authors of that when it came out, but I went back to it to sort of, because Carly's contribution to the Beach Boys is mostly these, you know, live shows for 10 years or so, and this book is just a fantastic book. If you're a Beach Boys nut, you might want to go back and pick up a copy of it, because the format of the book and the way it's done, it's just really, really well done. Also, if you're listening to this podcast and you're not a regular listener, you're listening because you're a Beach Boys nut like I am, you should look at the archives over at WFMU.org/Michael, and you'll find interviews with David Marks, I think a couple times, Brian Wilson, Billy Hinchey, Ron Altback, a few Beach Boys related authors. I must be forgetting some, but there's a lot of Beach Boys related stuff over at WFMU.org/Michael. Go check out the archives. Okay, just a sweetest guy. I can't wait till next time I'm in Puerto Rico. I'm definitely going to go visit Carly Munoz. Here is my interview with him. There's Dennis Wilson with Under the Moonlight, and that is, of course, written and produced by today's guest, Carly Munoz. Carly, good morning, and welcome to WFMU. How are you?
I'm great, Michael. Good morning, and well, thank you for having me on your radio show.
All the way from Puerto Rico.
And good morning to everyone listening to us. Yeah.
I'm glad you could join us. It's such, your history is a very interesting story, and I know that you've been playing jazz now for years, although your new record kind of harkens back to stuff, but I want to take you way back. I mean, tell me what was the first thing that you heard, maybe it was on the radio, something, a record your parents had, something that got you jazzed about playing music?
Oh, well, that was a little earlier on in the 1950s. I must have been late 50s, of course. I was born in 1948, so I was 12 in 1960, so probably I must have been around 9 years old, and I started hearing some of my first records that I had in my hands were Boogie Woogie, and some jazz, and some of the very, you know, Stagg O'Lee. I remember I had a record that had a combination of a lot of, you know, it was a combination of hits from the time. And that was very impressive. Also, I, you know, as a kid, I would see in the comic books, I would see the section of Columbia Club. I'm sure a lot of people my age can probably identify with that. And he said, well, for free, you can have like whatever, 12 records. And you know, that's all I could see. I mean, it didn't say anything about credit or, I mean, if there was something about age, it must have been very, very small print or whatever. But the thing is that I did go ahead and order those records. And I find later in my life, you know, receiving these letters that I owed all this money to Columbia Records, which I had no clue. But I wonder how many kids at that time got all those beautiful records. And I would get them basically because they look good. You know, the cover looked great. Somehow I had this attachment to this huge piano. You know, it's like on the cover, a concert grand, you know, wow, that's an impressive instrument. It was Peter Nero. And so that was one of my first albums, which is great. It was a great influence. It was a great, he was like a semi-classical player, but he excelled. He was like incredible jazz player as well. And his sound was very, very clean. And then later on in my life, I mean, some miracle happened at my house that suddenly one day there was a concert grandstand at my house, some crazy thing that my dad did. And I would, so then I would emulate that sound. And that got me to develop a clean sound for, you know, for jazz in a certain aspect of it. And then there was a raw aspect, which is a record that my dad also brought me from Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, plus Sabu. Sabu was a very famous conga player at the time. So I had here, was surrounded by this like very clean and Steinway semi-classical jazz sound, along with the ragtime and the honky-tonk and the boogie-woogie. And because the boogie-woogies were some of the first pieces that I started playing. And so the soup was right, you know, all the ingredients that gave me a really good foundation when I was just by the time I was 10, 11, 12.
And Carly, did you teach yourself how to do this?
Oh, absolutely. My sister was taken piano lessons. I think she took lessons for 4 years and she played the same song forever. You know, a hideous song that, you know, she would read. And I guess that influenced me negatively, you know, so I'll never do that. You know, it's like someone who plays for a lease, you know, for 4 years. But it was even a worse example, you know, a song called Amapola or something like that. I don't know if anyone can relate to that. But I didn't want to go that route. You know, I was, you know, whenever I would see a piano, everywhere I went, I had an uncle that had a grand piano in his living room. We'd go visit them, and I would just jump on the piano and start picking up stuff, and everybody would be, wow, well, how come he's playing like that? So, you know, that's part of what motivated my dad to give me to have this concert grandstand we had at the house. So anyway, that's basically what happened. I taught myself. I found it easy to sit down and figure out things on my own.
At a very young age, I think you started playing in bands and playing out in clubs and stuff. Is that right? I mean, was there a club scene in Puerto Rico in the late 50s?
Right. There was, but even before that, there was when we were still like early teenagers, there was the dance scene. See, there was a social thing, you know, the social clubs, the military clubs, like that. So fraternity and sorority clubs. So the first band I had was a neighbor's band, you know, the same kids that we would like throw rocks and play with. Some of them have, well, you know, maybe an accordion list on some cheesy like that, and another one maybe has some bongos in his house. So I said, well, okay, you're going to be the drummer, so, you know, get your parents somehow, you know, to buy you or break your piggy bank, and, you know, you have to get a set of drums, and you, the accordion player, you're going to do that, and another guy that had an old guitar, you're going to, you know, play the bass, because, you know, just get rid of some strings, and you know, I'll do with the piano. So I formed this group with my friends, you know, and it's like great. I taught the drummer. I didn't know, but since I was able to learn well, you know, I didn't have to take lessons. It didn't take me much to figure out how to play music. Well, I would learn the beats and I would teach the drummer, okay, this is what you have to do. And that was a dance band. And dance, I mean, like local music, like at the time were like plena, merengue, bolero, you know, local Latin dance music, you know. So we did that for a while. And then some horn players wanted to join in. They joined in, became a very popular band. And as kids in early high school days, we were making like a lot of money, like $300 a week. You know, that was a lot of money. And so that was very encouraging. And so then came the sound of the rock got bigger, got to be more popular. So then, of course, wanted to shift towards that area. So I took two of the guys, the bass player and the drummer. I picked up the bass and took the guitar player, who was already doing some riffs in rock, and the drummer. We did a little rock trio. We didn't even have a name. Our first gig, in our interview, that the promoter said, "Well, what is the name of the band?" So I looked. We have wearing this real cheesy red chemise shirt. He said, "Well, we're the Red Fever." So that was the name of that very first rock band. And I don't know how long we lasted, but we did a few little dances around. Then the very pivotal thing happened to me. It was the summer. I saw in the newspaper that my dad had in the kitchen, I saw the name Sabu Martinez. Remember I mentioned Sabu Martinez? Well, he was in town. He was performing every night somewhere in town. So I got excited. My God, this is the name from my first record when I was a kid, one of my very first jazz records. So I got to go see this guy. He's here. You know, it's a big name. So I grabbed a suit my dad had bought me. I shaved my few hairs and asked him for the car. At that time, there were very, very few cars in Puerto Rico. And, you know, so it was fairly, and I was taller. I looked older and then dressed like that. So even though I must have been like 12 and a half, you know, I managed to drive and get into this nightclub, this hardcore nightclub where they have this incredible jazz band, and Sabu Martinez was playing with them. So I went every single night during that summer. One night, the bass player doesn't show up. They were kind of at a loss because they had to do the show. So I just jump on stage and I say, "Hey, I can play the bass. I can do the part." So they, well, we have no choice. So they let me do it. I had never had an upright bass in my hand. But I had played bass in that little rock band, you know, with a real, you know, a Fender bass. So I faked it all through the show. You know, since I was good at picking up, I had heard the show every night for so long that I knew the show. So I accompanied them. So they asked me to stay with the band. Not as their bass player, but then they saw that I could fiddle around with the piano. They showed me how to open the chords a little bit. On the fly, they show me some things, and I became a jazz piano player with the top jazz man in Puerto Rico. They were all like at least 30, 40 years older than I was. And Joe Morello used to go there and jam with them. You know, everyone. It was a time when a lot of great bands came to Puerto Rico, and they had orchestra and Sammy Davis Jr., Liza Minnelli, you know, so Frank Sinatra. All the stuff was going on at that time. It was very, very buoyant, very much happening. So we had a lot of incredible guests there. So that was my first experience with jazz.
But you did go back to playing in rock bands. I mean, I assume that the Beatles kind of changed everything for everyone.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Yes. Well, one night I was doing that gig with his fabulous jazz band, and this guy comes in. He's in the crowd, and he says, "Carly, I know you, you know, through reference. I seen you around, and I heard you, and I would love to put together a band with you, a rock band." And he just caught my ears. You know, he got my attention. And I said, okay, let's do it. So we went ahead and formed this band called The Living End. It just turned out to be a great band.
I read somewhere that at one point you played in brothels. Is that true?
Oh, yeah, totally. Well, not only not only with that band, because there were at the time there were like a lot of brothels here in Puerto Rico, but later, much later, when I lived in California, at first when I first just had to do gigs and I just had to do gigs to eat and survive, I was playing brothels for, you know, piano for, you know, like sometimes three different ones in a night until 11 o'clock in the next morning. But those are two different stories.
Yeah, well, I guess a gig is a gig is a gig. Well, so the Living End became pretty well known. And in some ways, I guess you guys were in the local news as being the corruptors of youth. I mean, what was happening in Puerto Rico? What was happening in Puerto Rico that they were reacting so badly to teenage music?
Well, somehow this book gets to my hand called The Doors of Perception by Adolf Huxley. And, of course, I read it. It caught my attention. And it was like a form of serendipity, you know. Then one of the guys in the group, actually the gal in the group, some friends had brought in some acid from New York. You know, they were, like, smuggling it in, you know, in their body and stuff like that. So I just happened to read a book about it. The experience. So my friends that were going to have their first trip. By then we had a little place in Old San Juan. It was like a little old penthouse, and with an incredible view. So we were there, and we had in our hands some what was called like the white Huxley tablets, which were like some of the original, you know, like brand acids. So we took those. I took a whole one. You know, I know my friends that break in half or something like that. But anyway, I wanted to experience the whole thing. I figured if I take a whole one, I'd experience the whole thing. So that was a totally a life changing story. Everything that I knew was reality crumbled, but in a very, you know, beautiful way. You know. I was, you know, that totally changed my life, changed our life, changed what we were playing. Then whenever we rehearsed, we would, you know, all the stuff that didn't work, you know, then that was acid, playing on acid was like our measuring stick to what we were doing, whether it was effective, was good or not. So then we just became this incredible man with this great following kids that were like, you know, smoking pot and doing acid as well and all stuff. So that's how we got that rap. So we were like the first band that were playing on acid.
Oh, so you really were the corruptors of youth. I mean,
we were, yeah, we really were. So it came out in the newspaper.
So you were that's very interesting. So you guys were playing, but you're popular. You're playing. You're on TV. You're in clubs. You're in hotels, and the pressure sort of gets too much. So you guys go first to St. Thomas, and then you wind up in New York City, where you guys quickly become the house band at DJ Scott Muni's Rolling Stone Club on 48th Street and 2nd Avenue. So tell me, what's a typical day when you are the house band at a club like that?
Well, life was really at the club because I remember we were playing until very, very late. You know, they didn't have those like curfews that they have nowadays. You know, I don't know if they have it in New York still, but they were very late nights. And then besides, you know, we had so many friends, you know, there and hang arounders and people who would hang around until practically the next day. And then so the rest of the time was probably sleeping. sleeping, having something to eat, and go to the club, you know. So our life was really at the club.
And how long did you play? I mean, how many sets a night?
It was pretty much, we did what we wanted. You know, I mean, we literally did what we wanted. We would play, we play long sets. And people would be, like, very euphoric. We had these songs that were, like epic songs with, like, in the middle. They had this, like, jungle beats, and people would go crazy. I can tell you a typical day, an atypical day. Actually, it happened when we were playing at the Wagon Wheel. I went out, I was invited by some friends from New Rochelle to go ski on a boat, and it was, there was snow already on the lake. So we were skiing and on acid, of course. the guitar player and myself, we both went, and because we wanted to experience, I personally wanted to experience everything in my life I ever did. I wanted to see it through those eyes again, because it was, of course, very different. So skiing on this high power boat in some, you know, lake off state New York, and that was quite an experience. So then I, of course, we're like really out of our heads. It's on acid. So we get back to town because we're playing that night and we're late and we're terrified because we're late. And the band was, you know, we had agreed that we would never be late. You know, we had a very good sense of responsibility regarding that. But it was, you know, it was impossible to beat that. So we get there. It's nighttime. So Billy and I, we go into the club, and the club is full. It's, I mean, it is a big, the band is already on stage playing. So Billy, who is a lead guitar player, and myself, organ, and so we snuck onto the stage, and while the band was playing and the euphoria of the people on the floor, I proceed to turn on the organ, which has like this thing, this amplifier, which is called a Leslie, which is housed in a wooden box, and there's this huge rotating speaker right in the bottom, which is what makes that or that unique organ tremolo sound. Okay, so it's a process where you have to hold a couple of buttons and start swinging around, you know, going around and around, and it works like this beating sound like a washing machine. So there I am. I'm still on acid, picking, and I'm watching this thing on stage while the band is playing, just going round and round and round. Just the most amazing thing, making this woo woo, this weird noise. So okay, so then, you know, once I get over that and the band starts looking funny at me, I proceed to go to the organ. Now the organ seemed to have like this, like it's, the keyboard seemed to be like curved to the side, and have this like infinite curve on both sides, much larger than life. And I go ahead, I'm looking at this, I'm like, you know, just looking at this phenomenal, having this phenomenal experience, you know. And I hit a note with one. I'm very timid about touching this thing at the moment. I hit just one note with a finger, and it just blasts out like a thousand trumpets, you know. It's just unbelievable. And I'm astounded. And the band's still looking at me, and they're playing. Meanwhile, the audience is out there like raving like crazy. And so then I proceed to play, and it was just the most incredible experience of playing that I ever had. I gelled into the band, of course, and it was like magic, you know, playing in that state of mind. And everything went, you know, more than well. It was all a very, very excited set, except that we were, you know, we still were kind of in heat with the rest of the band, Billy and myself. But we got through the night.
That is kind of a crazy story. The band, The Living End, ends up getting signed to Capitol Records, and supposed to make a record with producer Shadow Morton, who was sort of a big deal back then. Yeah, so how did that go?
Regarding Shadow Morton and what was supposed to be, it didn't go very well. So we get thrown in this studio. It was in Long Beach, New York. And we moved there. The studio is there. Shadow Morton, I guess he picked the studio, who's going to be the producer. So we're there day in, day out. No sign of Shadow Morton. A shadow, actually. And he did show up one day and started doing some gestures with his hands, you know, Phil Spector-like gestures. He was drunk, and then he left. That was it. So basically, we were left on our own, these kids from an island in the Caribbean who had very little experience. I had never been inside a studio. And there we are, you know, what do we do? So we basically, we self-produced, and we did the best we could, but I suppose it just wasn't, it wasn't polished enough. And Capitol Records, you know, they put the record out, it got printed, but somehow, you know, there was no marketing, there was, you know, somehow the ball was dropped. of course, we dropped the ball as well, because then we started like falling apart ourselves as a group.
Yeah, so the band ended up breaking up in 1969 about, and you moved to Los Angeles. One of the first things you do is you jam with some of the guys who are sidemen in the Beach Boys band, or mutual friends with those guys, and I believe, right. And correct me if this is wrong, you're roommates with this guy named Jack Riley, who interviews the Beach Boys. They're so impressed with him that they ask him to be their manager. And Jack Riley's
their manager.
Yeah, and he was kind of a, some people in the band hated him, some people in the band loved him, and he wrote lyrics. He was a real controversial figure for the band. What kind of a guy was he?
Of course. To me, he was a good friend, a great friend. When I met him, he was a journalist for NBC in Puerto Rico, and he was the anchor man for that. And he was a very well-learned man from a very well-to-do family in Wisconsin. His family was they own a company called General Plastics, but he was a rebel. He was the oldest of the children. He has a surviving brother, and very 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 bright man. He was involved in politics, you know, with the Democratic Party, and he also had a lot of contacts. A man of great ideas. And he impressed the Beach Boys very much. I mean, sometimes he would go over the edge. He could be a controlling person. You know, I can't deny that I could see where he could be perceived, and rightly so perceived as that, because he had so much. I mean, he had it so together. I mean, he got the band out of, you know, metaphorically out of the striped shirts and physically, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he got in hip. He, you know, he's the one who confronted them with that.
Well, it's a very interesting time that you were with the band, because you jammed with them for a couple of gigs in, I think, 1969. You played percussion with them, and Daryl Dragon was on keyboards, and they heard you playing keyboards, and a couple of years later, around 1973, they asked you to join the touring band on keyboards, and you're with the band almost the entirety of 73 to about 81, and it's an amazing time for the band, because like you said, they were working hard to change their image. And at the beginning of that time, I don't know if you know the book Beach Boys in Concert. It's sort of really interesting book, and I was looking at all, it lists every gig, and some of the gigs, very, very few people were coming to, you know, and the band just didn't know what to do. They were trying to play, they were getting booed when they were playing new songs, and so they're trying to kind of reinvent themselves. So I think it's very interesting for you to sort of have a window into what was going on there. The first thing is, did you have a lot of rehearsal when you joined, or did you just get thrown in?
Both. We had rehearsals, but let's say no more than 3 rehearsals before I you know, started playing the concerts.
And was Carl kind of he's always has the reputation of sort of the musical director. Was he the guy telling you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He knew the details. He knew what he wanted. He knew what needed to be done. And he handled those musical details, you know, that made it sound good.
Let me remind everybody that Carly Munoz is our guest. He's done a million things, and he's got a brand new album called In My Soul, and you can check out his website, which is carlymunoz.com, for information about all his stuff that he's done and his history, and a lot of interesting information there. It was kind of, at that time, it was sort of a band at odds. I mean, there were literally fist fights between members of the band. I guess when you're a side man, you kind of try to stay out of the way, but it's kind of there's a lot going on.
Right, there's a lot going on. There's, you know, many, many, many days on tour, egos, girls, you know, hungry like a wolf, you know, all those things. You know, it's a lot of craziness when, you know, that may take over at one time or another. It happens.
Yeah. During that time, the Wilson brothers' dad passed away, 1973. Were you there when that happened? Did you see the reaction?
Yes, totally.
What was the reaction from the brothers?
It was very emotional. I remember I don't remember exactly where we were. We were around the Midwest, I believe. And Carl was very affected in a kind of a weird way. Carl and Dennis were both affected. I remember we were at one of the suites. I don't remember if it was Carl's or Dennis or mine, but at some point we all hugged. You know, we're like a group hug, and they were crying, and I was crying because they were crying, and you know, it was like just at that moment, that of realization. You know, my dad just died; he's not there. And another thing that happened is that before that, this was in the evening, but during the afternoon, when the news came up, I passed Carl in the hallway of one the hotel we're staying, and Carl gives me this extension cord, you know, those yellow extension cords that have like a light fixture on the end with a mesh, with a wire mesh. He gives me, here, Carly, I went to the, and this is on the road, I went to the hardware store, I got this for you, with a lot of sadness. You know, didn't say anymore. So I received it, I took it in my hands, I didn't know what to make of it. But that was his reaction to his father's death. That was his initial reaction. Somehow, they'll go to a hardware store and buy me a light extension. I mentioned that because it was just like, to this day, I can't figure it out, you know?
Yeah, that's really, I think only Dennis... And I think Dennis and Brian did not go to the funeral. I think only Carl went to the funeral. I mean, obviously, they had a complicated relationship with their father.
Right.
So around 1974, the Endless Summer LP, there's that double best of kind of comes out. And it really changes the whole career of the band. And like now, all of a sudden, you guys are playing to 50,000 people and 20,000 people. And it's like a whole new thing. For, like you said, you know, they're no longer in their striped shirts now. They're kind of hip in a way. And, I mean, that must have been a really fun time.
Yes, it was. But they were already, I mean, by the time the Beach Boys, they were like, you know, they had beards, they were dressing different, and they were already, they already had shifted their image. And even the songs, how they were being played, their horn section and a percussion, and you know, it was just a whole other thing. So I mean, from those days on, I mean, when they played the Fillmore East, the band was pretty hip then too.
Tell me about, I mean, Brian Wilson in that time. That was sort of such a strange time. In the time you were in the touring Beach Boys, he went from sort of being skinny to chubby to looking like a caveman to being in the band, out of the band, you know, the whole Brian is back thing, the Eugene Landy thing. There's a lot of reports of him kind of being on stage, but not being there, you know, in his... psyche, you know, and wandering around, and just it must have been sort of hard to watch that.
Yeah, it was, and all of that is true. I mean, it was hard. It was very sad. For example, during the trip to Japan, that was the saddest. I think it was totally miserable. I mean, miserable is just not enough to how he was throughout the whole trip. On the way to Japan, in Japan. During the transportation in Japan, I mean, he had his head down and pressure his hand on his forehead the whole time looking down. I mean, it was sad. That was truly, truly, truly sad.
Would it have been better for him to stay home? I mean, were they just pushing him too much, or was it good for him in the end to get out?
You know, it's really hard to tell, because staying home, well, what would the outcome of that would have been? But so. Maybe pushing him out and into like concert. Maybe that was good, but maybe hard, but means to an end of him, you know, perhaps getting it together later. I mean, the Eugene Landy thing was pathetic. That was, I mean, I saw the whole thing, and I mean, his brothers couldn't talk to him. You know, I just couldn't. I couldn't get over that.
Because he had bodyguards around, and they just...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Eugene totally controlled him. Totally. 100%. I mean, no one could get near him.
Did you have some musical moments with Brian? I mean, were he, you know, you guys, because you're both keyboard players, was he, because he is a genius, you know?
Yeah, totally. Oh, yeah. In recordings, you know, he didn't talk to anybody. He was very, very, very difficult. I mean, you couldn't just go to him and talk because he just wouldn't talk. And I see some people trying that, especially guest bands that would travel with us, like America and other bands. And you know, but he wouldn't, you know, he just wasn't so well. But one time he came up to me, you know, during those days, he was on a flight, and he crossed the aisle and to ask me how come I could play his music so well. I'll never forget that. And I wanted to answer to him, honestly, you know, my mistake, because it just shook him. It just like freaked him out. I said, well, that's because when I first fed sounds, I was on acid. And he just got scared and went back to his seat, you know. So, but it's the truth. I mean, it's like I could get to the soul of that whole thing. It was like ingrained. I could almost see what he was doing, you know, when I would play it or when I would hear it. I could totally own it and be a part of it. So I could, of course, I play it well.
How interesting. So tell me about Mike Love. I mean, it's such a strange character. And I read that in 1977, for a few shows, you got fired because Mike Love only wanted the band to have guys who meditated in the band. Eventually, you got back in the band. But, I mean, he sounds like there's more bad stories than good about Mike. What's your impression?
Well, I'll tell you another time. A lot of things happen on a plane, on a flight. Mike Love comes up to me, you know, everyone is there, and he crosses the aisle and says, Carly, I heard you got initiated in transcendental meditation. I guess something, you know, he wanted everybody to hear that I did, which was correct. And I answered again, I was more honest than I probably should have. And I said, yeah, Mike. I got initiated in 1968 in New York, but I went, got my money back and bought an old Chevy.
So that was the end of it.
Everybody started laughing. Yeah, that was the end of my relationship with Mike Love. Everybody started laughing, you know, which that really, you know, nailed the coffin, you know?
Yeah. That's so funny. So was being a sideman, did it pay okay during that time? I mean, I can't even imagine what.
Oh yeah. It was good, and if I felt that I needed to raise or get paid more or something like that, there was never any problem with that. Plus, you know, just me to pay me separate for recording sessions and TV and all, you know, everything. Yeah, they were very, very fair with their payment, and plus at some point they initiated a pension plan, which was really great. You know, like when I left, it was a great cushion.
Very forward of them. So during a lot of the time you were with the Beach Boys, Dennis had hurt his hand, cut it doing something, and didn't play the drums. And he kind of walked around stage and sometimes played the piano and sang. And and at a certain point, it just got so distractive. I think he was banned from being in the band. But I know that you and him developed a close relationship. And he, from 1975 to 77, he made his first album, Pacific Ocean Blue. And when it came time to make his second record, he asked you to be his collaborator. He wanted to do your songs and have you produce the record. And we heard Under the Moonlight at the beginning of the show. That was one of the songs that would have been on this record. Why didn't he end up finishing that record?
Well, things went bad for him. I mean, I believe his own doing. You know, his relationship with Karen Lamb was going on a precipice, which was going really way downhill, and there was a lot of, you know, emotional turmoil, and that emotional turmoil, you know, it shifted also with his relationship with the band. So it was, you know, he at some point became like the black sheep. Mike was Mike wouldn't tolerate his behavior, and they were like oil and water. So he just kept going downhill. He started drinking a lot, doing other stuff. And there were some people around him that were fitting that way of life as well. You know, that weren't very supportive. On the other hand, they provided means for self-destruction. And it was very hard to handle. He was very independent. You couldn't just tell him, Dennis, don't do that, or you can't do that. He was very volatile. So things started, you know, going downhill and going to the studio more erratic and late, very, very late night, sometimes not showing up. And it was so erratic that for me as a partner, you know, as doing this, co-producing this project, at some point, you know, it was after the four initial songs, it just became very hard. Plus, I had children. I had babies. I had four beautiful little children that I was raising, and my home in Pasadena, you know, and having, you know, a normal day, you know, school and being a father and all this stuff. And I it just became very hard for me to live his life, you know.
Yeah. Did you write those four songs for Dennis, or were they songs that
No, I never wrote, and I didn't write any song for Dennis. Those songs I had written before, like the earliest one, which is It's Not Too Late. I don't know if you heard that.
Sure.
That I wrote in 1968, actually, in New York, when I was still in New York. And all those songs I wrote basically in like around 69, 1970, 1971, maybe 1972. The only one, I mean, there's some that I finished the work or I revamped the work later, like now, like 2007, 2008, you know, for the Denovulation is the only one that's actually is new. That wouldn't have been there at the time that I produced Dennis. That's the only song that's really new. Oh, and there's the a cappella one. The a cappella one is I wrote those times, but I couldn't say for sure whether that song would have been on the album or not.
So the record Bamboo sort of ended up coming out eventually all the way in 2008 with your songs. And I take it it's not a release that you had too much involvement with, but it must be nice that those songs are out there and that folks can hear them. And is that right?
Oh, absolutely. At the time, I wasn't happy with the fact that they did this behind my back, knowing my role in it. But in the end, you know, when after Warner Chappell approached me, the publishing company, which they had to go through me. I mean, they could do everything, but they, in the end, they knew they had to go through me. They had to get my permission, because those four songs are the only real original songs from Bamboo. They were the pillar. Everything else was like, let's say, a filler of sorts. Some good, you know, don't take me wrong, some good songs, but they were intended for that album. They were taken from their takes that were done for other projects or that were done, you know, later, you know, being in the studio here, there in Venice Beach, you know, like an experiment or something, bits and pieces. But those four songs were completed, except for I would have done the vocal over something, especially in All Alone. So they just needed to be, they have rough mixes. In fact, there were a lot of bootlegs, albums out there at some point, because there were some rough, you know, taken from those rough mixes that, and Dennis, on occasion, he would take a rough mix and a tape that they didn't give it to a friend. And, you know, there it goes out in the world, you know, it's a bootleg.
Yeah. So better to have the closer to the real versions out there. So tell me when, I mean, how did you know it was time to leave the Beach Boys organization?
It was 1981. I remember it distinctively. It was the last concert. It was a local concert. I think it was in Studio City. It was in L.A. And the erratic behavior. I mean, that night, Dennis walked in on the drums, literally on top of the drums, like tumbling, you know, drunk. And Mike wanted to kill him on stage. And I said, that's enough, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there were times when I had to separate Dennis physically from fighting on the plane, inside on the cabin of the plane with Michael. And everybody was freaking out. And nobody dared to touch him, especially nobody dared to touch Dennis, because he didn't, you know, he was, you know, there was a time when Jerry Schilling, who was Carl Wilson's manager on the road, he had to go back and wake me up and tell me, look, there's a problem. Dennis and Michael are just about to go at it. They're nose to nose. So I said, why me? You know, I had to get up. And because Dennis had trust for me. See, just the only way it could be done. Otherwise, it would have created a worse conflict. I grab him from the back, you know, just a hold, and ask him, what the hell is he doing? And you know what he whispered in my ear?
No.
I'm just fucking with him. You know, he was creating a scene just to freak everybody out, just so everybody would be in panic while the plane is on the air. And there's about to be this fist fight, you know, on the cabin.
I mean, why was he such a tortured guy? What is it that drove him to be that way?
Well, Dennis the Menace. You know, I believe they must have taken the story out of him or something like that. It's just his nature, you know.
Yeah.
I asked him once, what is it that, this is a very personal aspect, a very revealing answer to that, very deep emotional answer. And I asked him in a very solitary moment, Dennis, why? What did Mike ever do to you? By the way, I asked the same question to Mike later on. What did Mike do to you? Well, he answered, oh, I'm going to tell you. One time I was doing acid, and he put me in the back of a motorcycle, took me for a ride, and freaked me out. You know, went just crazy just to freak me out. So he freaked him out.
Hmm.
That was his answer.
Okay.
So.
And what did Mike say?
You know, Mike, I asked fairly recently, because they've been to Puerto Rico a couple of times, and when they come, you know, we always get together, and you know, we have a congenial time, the congenial times that we never had before on the road. I asked him like that, very personally, Mike, what did Dennis ever do? I don't know if I should say the answer. Actually, I will reserve the answer because it could be a... could be damaging to him.
Okay, fair enough. You've been more than candid, so I can't fault you for that.
I'm sorry on that. Just that it's, you know, Mike. You know, we have come a long ways to, you know, be, you know, both friends and called. You know, we have a relationship that we never had before, and you know, it's not that we're each other's favorite person or anything like that, but. You know,
you've got some history. That's nice.
And we've got some history. And
I enjoy going to see Mike's band. I enjoy going to see Brian's band. They're different, but it's really interesting to see both of them. And it's always very moving.
It is.
I mean, there's one thing, you know, through all of this, you know, there are moments when you just hear the original guys and Bruce and just everybody in there singing those harmonies. And it really is pretty amazing. You know, I mean, that's one thing throughout all of this is like you hear those five guys, six guys sing that way. And it really is a very special thing.
It is. It is. I loved it mostly when they did a cappella, you know, which they just sat around and, you know, not necessarily on stage, but backstage or something on a rehearsal. They do in a cappella. It was just such a special moment. It's just like a heart warming moment, you know, very, 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 very special.
Yeah. So Dennis died in 1983. And interestingly, you, you ended up playing with all kinds of people, George Benson and Chico Hamilton and Les McCann. You joined a country band for a while. You played with the Association, yeah. Peter Cetera. And then you decided to stop all that. And I think around 1986, you studied cinematography. You moved back to Puerto Rico with your family, and you started a company making commercials and documentaries. And then 1989, you went back and started your jazz trio. You opened your restaurant, Carly's Fine Bistro and Piano Bar in Old San Juan, which is a beautiful part of Puerto Rico. And since then, you've kind of been mostly back doing jazz and running this restaurant, and like a whole nother chapter in your life. And as we said, there's the new CD, In My Soul, and people get information at CarlyMunoz.com.
Yeah.
What an interesting life you've had. I mean, it sounds like you're sort of a happy, well-adjusted guy. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. We have a new child. She's 10 years old now with my current wife, Katira. And we're very happy. We're a very happy family. You know, we work very hard. And, you know, we enjoy where we are, even though, you know, there's some political, not political, but financial crisis now, you know, in Puerto Rico. It's, you know, it's worldwide known. And, but, you know, we'll get through all that. And, but it still is an incredible place to live, an incredible place to be, you know, almost sunshine all the time and really nice people. And, you know, we just really enjoying being here.
When I visited Puerto Rico, the people were so friendly and so especially welcoming to my daughter, who was very little at the time. And we just felt very, very warm, a wonderful place. And WFMU's Matt and Amanda went and saw you play. And that's how I ended up getting your information. And they said it was a really fun time. And anyone who's visiting Puerto Rico should stop by your bistro. And how often do you actually play music in the restaurant?
Well, I was open every night, and I've been open for, it's going to be, this year is going to be 19th years, the 19th year. I was playing every night. We closed one night a week, like Sunday, only Sundays. But now I have a guest artist on Thursdays and on Saturday. I have a Brazilian music on Thursdays and 60s, 70s rock on Saturdays, and it's turned out very well. Let's see that. All the other nights I play every single night. So I'm playing 8 o'clock. Some nights I play by myself. Some nights I play duo. I play with my trio. I have a guest. The beauty is that there's always something different. You know, a lot of people coming, you know, Al Jarreau came to visit one time, and all the different people, but also lesser known, you know, artists and people that come off the ships from the dock, you know, great musicians. So all kinds of really cool things happening. It's so much fun. I mean, it's like having a party every night, basically. I love the food. I love food. I love fine dining. In fact, when there was a time in the Beach Boys when you know everyone was there, that I was the guy to go find a fine dining restaurant. For example, to go to Australia, I'd be the guy in Sydney to go. Okay, gotta go find us a great, you know, fine dining restaurant, and because I love to eat well, and I like wines, and, you know, traveling at that level, you know, it really gave me an opportunity to explore places and get to, you know, have that experience. So it's a way of recreating that experience, you know, at my club, you know, but with the music. I believe, you know, jazz is more appropriate for a small club like that, and which is something I love. It's very natural for me. In fact, I have made 7 CDs solo since I got back, and the other 6 are all jazz.
Yeah, and folks can get information, like I said, at your website, CarlyMunoz.com. And I listened to, if you go on the web, you can hear your appearance on Marion McPartland's radio show, where you both play piano, and you can hear Carly play some amazing jazz piano. I want to go out of here with a track from the In Concert LP, which is a record you play on. I think you're mostly playing organ on the record. Do you have a favorite track from that?
Yes, Leaving This Town.
Is that a song that Blondie wrote, I think?
Yeah, Blondie. I think there's some collaboration there.
Hmm.
I think Carl, I could be mistaken, but I believe there's some, you know, Blondie and Carl, maybe someone else, but Blondie sings the lead on it. And there I get unleashed totally unleashed on an organ solo.
Yeah, they let you go crazy in the middle of that one. Yeah, and it's kind of a really interesting thing. Yeah, I mean, that was a really interesting band because it was a pretty powerful band, especially, you know, I love the way Dennis was drumming, but he does not play drums on this stuff, and Ricky's playing a lot more powerfully. I don't know. There's a lot more going on. Let's hear that now. Carly Munoz, thank you so much. This has been really interesting and fun, and I appreciate your candidness.
Michael, what a joy. It's a pleasure for me. And thank you for everyone out there listening to this. It's really, it's really fun to share some of these stories with you.
Long to see you, oh my love, I long to feel you near. My need is deep inside. from a dream to see reflections all around me. New reality.
Thank you very much.